Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and earned a BA in history from Cornell University and a master's degree in journalism from Columbia University. Since 1984, he's covered the auto industry for the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Free Press, Bloomberg, and Forbes. And since 2014, he's been the host of In the Driver's Seat on Sirius XM Radio. The author of three books and a mensch. His name, Daron Levine. And we're honored to him as our guest. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're talking to Daron Levine, a longtime great friend, mentor, and since 2014, he's been the host of In the Driver's Seat on Sirius XM Radio. Daron, welcome. A real honor.
Hey, thanks very much for having me on the show, Jack. I love you, and it's such a great experience to be with you here.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
Sure. I have a really interesting background. It would take a long time to tell you all of it, so I'll just give you the short version. My late father was born in South Africa and grew up in South Africa. My mom actually was born in Pittsburgh, grew up in Cleveland, and in 1948, they decided, each of them separately, they didn't know each other at the time, but they decided to go to the Middle East because there was going to be a conflict in Palestine, which became Israel, and they were recruited because of their Jewish faith. My dad, because of his military background in the British Army in World War II, and my mom, because she was a nurse and had medical background. She had just graduated from nursing school. They went to Israel, and they got married there, and I was born in Israel. So my parents were part of the original group that founded the State of Israel, and I was one of the first youngsters to be born in the State of Israel.
What's the biggest thing you learned from mom, and what's the biggest thing you learned from dad?
Well, obviously, one of the things was this love of peoplehood, was love of my religion, love of my people, a historical sense of 5,000 years of history, our wanderings all over the globe, and really a love of learning. So one of the things that was always important in our house was to learn and to understand and to read and to ask questions and to seek answers. And so we always had lively discussions about everything, about science, about politics, about history, about religion, about our own background, about who our relatives were. And I was a very, very inquisitive child. And that was something that my father said a lot about me. And that was a word that he used a lot. He used to ask me, "Why are you so inquisitive?" I said, "Dad, because you made me that way."
Speaking of making you that way, where did you get your love for writing?
I was very fortunate because my parents, valuing education the way they did, we moved around quite a bit. My dad was an engineer and my mom was a nurse, and we lived in Israel, then we lived in South Africa, and then for various reasons having to do partly with the political situation in South Africa, we decided to come to the United States. So we moved a lot. But every place we went, my parents' first question always was, what are the schools like? What are the educational opportunities? So everywhere we went, we were always seeking out the best schools, whether we were coming to Pittsburgh or being in New Jersey for a while or being in South Africa for a while. My parents' first question always was, well, what kind of opportunities are we going to have to send this child and also my two sisters to school? And so we got excellent educations.
What do all great writers, Daron, have in common?
I don't know the answer to that, but I think one of the things that helped me in my house was that my mom always insisted that I write thank you notes to relatives, and she didn't let me blow off a thank you note. Well, thanks, Grandma, for the $10 check you sent me. Love, Daron. She wanted me to write a letter, really thanking my grandma, telling her a little bit about myself, telling my grandpa a little bit about myself, and if I didn't do it properly. She made me do it again. So I finally figured out that I had to write a nice thank you note. And I started doing that when I was very, very young. And I think that that probably really helped me to gain some writing skill, just because my parents insisted that I always write thank you notes. And when I was 10, they sent me to Israel to my uncle, and my mother handed me a blank diary. And she said, I want this to be full when you come home. So I want you to write in it every night. And I did. And I still have it. Believe it or not, from age 10, I have this diary of my summer in Israel, and I wrote in it every night.
We have a lot of things in common, one being we both write thank you notes.
Yeah.
But I never wrote my grandma thanking her for a $10 bill. I thanked her for a nickel and a dime to write. That's the difference. Okay, let's go on. God's really blessed you in so many ways. In 1975, you meet a lady, Adina. Changed your life. You were both serving in the Israeli military.
Correct. That's correct. Well, it's a long story as to how I ended up in the Israeli military, but basically because I was born in Israel, I was subject to the draft there. I went there after college wanting to be a journalist. I ended up in the Army, got drafted, was in the Army, and was there for basically 2.5 years, and toward the end of my service, I was in an office one day, and Adina was serving in an HR office there, and I had to get some papers signed, and we met and started dating, and I would say within 4 or 5 months we were married. So we both knew that was the right person, and that's part of our tradition, too. Our religious tradition is when you're with the right person and you know it's the right person, then you move forward from there.
And it's been a 43-year partnership, and it's a love affair. Every time you talk about her, it's your eyes smile. You are fascinated by her.
Well, she's just the best person on the earth, so that makes it easy for me. And we really like each other's company, and we look forward to seeing each other. And even if we're apart for a couple of hours, we're anxious to get back together again and talk about what happened the last couple hours. And, you know, some people complain about marriage and wonder why marriage is so difficult. And I have an easy answer for that, is because you never married anybody like Adina. If you had married somebody like Adina, marriage wouldn't be difficult.
A few weeks ago, we were having a meal, and you said, and I quote, marriage, it's always about the other person.
I got that piece of advice from a rabbi. And I think it's very simple, but very profound. This particular rabbi is somebody I studied with, and I was listening to him talk to somebody else who was about to get married, and that person asked him for some advice, and that's what he said. And I think that's really what a lifelong partnership is about, is finding somebody and finding the power within yourself to understand that it has to be about the other person first. And of course, it's great when they feel the same way about it. So it's very mutual and should be very mutual. And when you have that kind of mutual relationship, then you're going to have a good relationship.
We're talking to Doron Levine, and I'm Jack Krasula. And this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Doron Levine, who's a worldwide automotive industry expert and columnist. Speaking of which, talk about your chapter at the New York Times.
Okay, I think there are very few professions in which there's one pinnacle that everybody in the profession looks toward and wants to be at. And I think in journalism, if you're a young, aspiring, ambitious journalist, everybody wants to work for the New York Times. At least that's the way it used to be. I think that's not true today anymore because of the changes in technology and the changes in the newspaper business. But at least when I went into the newspaper business, everybody wanted to work eventually for the New York Times. And you understood that in order to get there, you would have to work at a small paper and then a slightly larger paper and then a slightly larger paper. And then if you were very good and very lucky, you might have a chance someday to work for the New York Times. And I was very, very fortunate to have that opportunity.
Speaking of which, paint for us a picture, Doron, of how the auto industry was covered by the press in 1984?
Well, first of all, the automobile industry, I think, in Detroit was still seen as pretty much an oligopoly, meaning a four companies, if you count American Motors, really dominated the industry, and the rest of the world looked up to the industry the way it was. It was really all about General Motors as being number one, Ford being number two, Chrysler being number three, and then American Motors being a distant four. And this was an industry that basically these were four companies that dominated the industry. Sure, you sold a couple of Jaguars and a couple of Toyotas and a couple of Mercedes-Benzes, but basically it was all about Chevrolet, Ford, Chrysler, Dodge, and AMC. And again, AMC being kind of a distant fourth, but the point was that it was so dominant and so economically important that everybody in Washington on the policy level and everybody in the banking system really thought about what was happening in the auto industry. You had to cover the basic sales, inventory, production, pricing, because it was an integral part of the U.S. economy. And the U.S. economy was very much entwined with that. They said that maybe a seventh of the national economy was tied in some way to the auto industry.
Speaking of dominating an industry, when E.F. Hutton talks, people listen. And when Daron Levine talks and or writes, we listen and or read. So let's talk about some of the great geniuses that you've covered over these past 35 years in the automotive sector.
When I landed in Detroit in 1984, I came here as a correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. I had already been working for them in another city. They had an open spot in their bureau here, and I was sent here. And among my duties was to cover General Motors. And it wasn't just me. There were several reporters covering General Motors. And so I met Roger Smith, who was the CEO at the time. And at that point, he was somewhat in a struggle. I didn't know it at the time, but behind the scenes, he was in a struggle with Ross Perot, a very wealthy Texan who had sold his company to General Motors and joined the General Motors board as a director, and there were beginning to be differences. So Roger was a very smart guy. Roger Smith was a very smart guy who was an accountant. He was starting to see the first signs of change in the industry and the first signs that the business was going to be different in a profound way because of Japanese cars that were coming into this market. And Ross Perot was a guy who didn't come from the auto industry. He was a self-made person who had built a computer services company down in Texas, and he had a lot of ideas for General Motors, but General Motors at that time was an extremely insular place that really wasn't interested in his ideas. And so that's what led to that conflict.
I think you once met Ross Perot. You actually wrote a book with Ross Perot called Irreconcilable
Differences. Correct. And they were in irreconcilable differences. And they resulted in Ross Perot leaving the company. But then ultimately running for president. But that's a whole nother story. The interesting part of that story was that it really brought me a lot of attention and my reporting a lot of attention. I ended up meeting Ross Perot just by virtue of a telephone call. I called him out of the blue, not expecting that he would even take my call. He did. He invited me down to Texas. We began to form a kind of a reporting relationship. He was telling me things that weren't public at the time. We were trying to figure out how to get it into the public arena in a way that wouldn't blow up the whole situation. The whole situation did blow up eventually, not necessarily because of my reporting, but I got a lot of attention because people were watching my stories to see what was going on. It was very important to other people in the industry and people in government and people in banking and in lending and so forth and in the supply chain. And so that brought me to a lot of prominence as well. And then the opportunity to write this book.
I think he once famously said that changing GM is like trying to teach an elephant how to tap dance.
Right. You got to know where the soft spots are, and you got to poke the elephant every now and then. And he was definitely poking the elephant at that point.
Speaking of poking, Lee Iacocca.
Okay, so another guy who was a very big deal at the time that I arrived was Lee Iacocca. Lee Iacocca had written a book about his sort of a memoir of his time at Ford Motor Company and his fights with Henry Ford II and his philosophy of business and his philosophy of leadership. And this was a phenomenal bestseller. I mean, they were selling millions and millions and millions of books, and it made Iacocca really a big celebrity. And he was able to kind of get off his chest a lot of his bitterness and anger and feelings of betrayal at how he had been fired at Ford Motor Company. And people love this sort of juicy story told from the inside, which is what he did. And we got to cover him here for the Wall Street Journal. Now, the truth is that Chrysler had many problems of its own and, in fact, was close to going bankrupt in the 80s and had to be bailed out by the U.S. government, which got a loan guarantee, which guaranteed a loan that kept Chrysler alive. So we covered that very, very closely. And there was a big debate among all kinds of people who thought perhaps the government shouldn't bail out Chrysler. It's not the government's job to bail out failing businesses. It's the government's job to stay out of the way and let them fail. And I think that's a legitimate point of view. But the fact was, at the time, for a lot of reasons, the government decided to get involved. It was first Jimmy Carter and then Reagan who helped Chrysler. And we covered all that in the Wall Street Journal and then subsequently in the New York Times. But it made us gave us a first name basis with Lee. And we interviewed him quite a bit and got to know him quite a bit.
We're talking to Doron Levine. Speaking of interviewing Iacocca quite a bit, you wrote a book about Iacocca, Behind the Wheel at Chrysler, the Iacocca Legacy.
Correct. And I was able to really write what I thought would be a good companion book to his story about himself, which kind of showed Chrysler in another light and how difficult it was for Chrysler to embrace some of the ideas that were coming from overseas, especially from companies like Honda and Toyota, which were introducing new ideas about manufacturing, about marketing, about quality, new measurements. I mean, Detroit thought it really knew everything about the auto industry and was a little bit dismissive of what was coming in from overseas and really needed a reality check. And I was hoping that this book would be something of a reality check for people who read it.
Another icon, Bob Lutz.
Yeah, well, Bob was also at Ford Motor Company and also had problems with the Ford Motor Company and ended up being hired by Lee Iacocca at Chrysler. And is a very larger-than-life figure, somebody that journalists love because he always has great quotes and always has great stories and is a gifted mimic. He knows how to mimic people in ways that make us laugh, especially when we've been out at one of these long liquid dinners and we're all laughing. And he's smoking his cigar, and he's a lot of fun to be with, and very knowledgeable, and lots of basic leadership skills and characteristics, and knows a lot about marketing. And incredibly, I guess he's well into his 80s now, and people still call him for interviews and to find out things, and he's involved in various businesses, and he seems almost beyond time, like he never slows down. And I always look forward to seeing him when he shows up at one of the auto shows, or he's on TV, he's written a couple of books himself.
We're talking to Doron Levine. When we come back, we're going to continue talking about some of the iconic figures that he's covered. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and with Doron Levine, who since 1984 has covered the auto industry for Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Detroit Free Press, Bloomberg, Forbes.
Yep.
Doron, you'd be good on the radio. You should try radio a little bit.
How I got this radio show is really sort of an interesting story. And like you, I believe in God, okay? I believe there's a creator, and I believe there's a plan, and I believe we have to fit into that plan somehow. And that's our job, is to figure out how we fit into that plan. So I'm walking around the L.A. Auto Show one day, and I see Greg Penske, Roger Penske's son. And he says, hey, come on over here. We talk a little bit. He says, you know, my friend at Sirius XM says he's looking for somebody to do a show on the auto industry. Would you possibly be interested in that? I said, sure, I'd be interested in it. And that's how the whole thing started, just a chance meeting at the LA Auto Show.
Speaking of chance meetings, Ford needed a new leader 10 years or so ago, and they go to Boeing and meet with Ellen Mullally. Tell us about Mullally.
Well, Ellen Mullally was somebody that nobody would have guessed would become the CEO of Ford Motor Company. But a couple of things had happened. First of all, he didn't get the top job at Boeing, and I think he wanted it. I think many people thought he deserved it. I think many people thought he'd be good at it. And so he was really in a position where he was kind of closed out from being the top guy at Boeing. Ford probably recognized that. I think Ford recognized that it needed a strong daily CEO. Bill Ford Jr. had been the executive chairman for a while. He had had various other people from Ford doing that job. He had done the job himself. Ford, things weren't working out so well on the leadership front at Ford, and this opportunity presented itself, and they brought him in, and I think nobody would have predicted this, but it turned out to be actually a terrific move for Ford Motor Company, and it probably stands as one of Bill Ford's Jr.'s smartest, best things that he did for Ford during his time, which was hiring Ellen Mullally.
What made him so good?
Well, first of all, there was focus and discipline. He really understood business, and he didn't get distracted by a lot of the sort of normal things that people get distracted by when they get in those offices. He was very much focused on the Ford brand, and he was organizationally very focused on making Ford a place where people pulled together, acted as a team, worked with one another as opposed to against one another. You know, some of these corporations, and I'd never worked inside Ford, but it probably suffers from the same things that many corporations suffer from, which is people competing against one another for promotions, for scarce resources, for attention, for all those things. And that often gets in the way, most of the time gets in the way of business. And so when you're a leader, you have to figure out how to keep a competitive atmosphere, but keep that from being negative or destructive or counterproductive, if you will. And Mullally was able to do that. And he very early on, he identified around him, among the senior executives, the fact that senior executives at Ford weren't working together as they should. And he basically put a chill on that very, very quickly. And people realized that either they were going to work together or they could just go someplace else. And he was able to do that in a good way and in a way that helped Ford.
We're talking to Doron Levine, and since 2014, he's been the host of In the Driver's Seat on Sirius XM Radio. A month ago, we were shocked, all of us, by the sudden death of Sergio Marchionne. Talk about Sergio.
Okay, Sergio was another figure that really nobody had paid much attention to in the auto industry and didn't fit the mold of what an auto industry executive was. He didn't come from the auto industry. He had been someplace else working in business and caught the attention of the Agnelli family, which was the controlling family and owner of Fiat. And they hired him to basically help get the Agnelli industrial empire straightened out. The Fiat company was not doing very well, and they had to get that outside of Fiat Industrial, and then they had to try to make it viable. And he was the guy who basically got Fiat on its feet and kind of in a shaky way at least rolling forward again. And then came the financial collapse of 2008-2009, which bankrupted Chrysler. And he recognized in Chrysler, and there was a chance there that Chrysler could have been liquidated, but he recognized in Chrysler an opportunity. And the opportunity was some very underutilized assets, one of them being Jeep, which was potentially very valuable and has proved to be very valuable. Another was the Ram pickup truck business in the United States, which has turned out to be extremely valuable, and to some extent the minivan business of Chrysler. And he was able to identify these and motivate his team, worked very, very hard, and really turned Fiat Chrysler, which was basically two weak companies tied together, he turned that into a pretty strong company before he died.
Carlos Ghosn.
Carlos Ghosn. Carlos Ghosn is a Brazilian who has ancestry that's Lebanese. So he's another one who doesn't quite fit the picture of what many Americans thought was the typical auto executive. And he had been at Michelin for a while. And basically, Renault hired him to go and find a way to acquire or make a deal with Nissan, which was failing in the late 1990s. And he went over there and he created an alliance, which was a situation where they traded shares, they kept their independence, but they worked together in ways that made sense for them, and then they stayed apart in ways that made sense to them. And this was the so-called Renault-Nissan alliance, which has really worked very, very well over these 20 years now, more than 20 years. And he's proved to be one of the great geniuses along with Marchionne. And I hear from background sources that they're jealous of one another, that Ghosn thinks he's the bigger genius, and Marchionne thought before he died that he was the bigger genius. The truth is they were both geniuses.
We both have been blessed to have a radio show. Johnny Janopoulos would say, with our face, we got a face for radio. And I get high marks. I get high marks because, Jack, you get fabulous guests and you let them talk. Your first show, you go to this person, Mary Barra, who doesn't quite fit the model in the auto industry.
Right.
Tell us about Mary Barra.
Well, Mary Barra was somebody who has a long and very strong career at General Motors, but we didn't know too much about on the outside. She had been in various engineering roles and had gone to Stanford Business School and had run HR. You know, nobody pays attention to the people who run HR generally in any organization, but she had done that, and it's a very important job at General Motors. And then when the then CEO of GM, after the bankruptcy and the reorganization, and Dan Akerson became the CEO, before he left, he designated her CEO, and people kind of go, who? I mean, people in GM knew her, but people in the press didn't really know who she was. And so she came out, and then immediately she finds herself under fire because of this ignition switch problem that General Motors had. And within months of getting this job, she's sitting in front of congressional inquisitors in Washington, and actually acquitted herself very, very well. She's very smart, very tough, and I would just say a really good leader. A lot of people at GM really respected her, and she really proved herself under fire very, very early on. And she's just gotten better and better, and I think gained more and more respect and regard since those days of the Senate congressional investigation into the ignition switch problem at General Motors. And I think if you took a poll now, you would find that people really, generally speaking, were very, very admiring of her. And she was very kind, and her people were very kind to come on my show early on, and got a lot of attention.
We're talking to Daron Levine, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible. Talking to Daron Levine, who's been our eyes and ears for the last 35 years about the Motor City's signature industry. Daron, I admire you for a lot of reasons. You're always looking to help other people while not expecting nor asking for anything in return. Why?
You know, people have just helped me, and I like to help people. I mean, I think that there's something pleasing in and of itself. If somebody needs a job, if I can help them or introduce them to somebody, can give them a job or tell them about, you know, they're ill and they need help. So I know about a doctor who specializes in this sort of thing, or if they need money or whatever it is. You know, you got to help people. You know, God put us on this earth to help one another. And so that's what we've got to do. That's what we're supposed to do. And that's what I'm going to do.
Let's go to autonomous vehicles, all right? We hear so much about driverless technology. Daron, how close are we, and who will be some of the winners?
Okay, those are the two important questions, two of the important questions, and there's no specific answers to them. But I can tell you we're a lot closer than people think. Sometimes you'll hear people say we're a lot further away than people think. All of these depend on what people think, and I'm not sure what people are thinking. But I can tell you I've been driven in driverless cars. I've seen the technology work. I'm impressed with the technology. I'm impressed with the people who are working on it. And the prize, the economic prize, is huge. So there's a real incentive to be first and to be best and to be involved. It's going to change the way we move around. It's going to change the way we think about vehicles. We've always thought about vehicles as being something we own. I think less and less vehicles are going to be things that we need to own ourselves. Vehicles are going to be out there and available, and they're going to come and get us when we need us, and then take us to where we're going, and then go about their business. The cities are too crowded and too polluted to really continue to have people bringing their cars to cities all the time. Cities need a different mobility answer than they have. And so you see this now in a lot of places like San Francisco and in London and in New York, cities that really have congestion problems. We're actually here in Detroit starting to have some congestion problems in various places. And that's a good thing. Everybody's happy about that because Detroit for such a long time was a place that was really bereft of human activity. I mean, there wasn't enough of it. It was kind of underutilized and it's starting to become utilized better. And eventually it'll be overutilized. And that's because young people like to come to cities and young people care more about their smartphones than they do about cars. So they don't really feel that they need to own cars. Like I say, it's going to happen very soon. And when you talk about who the winners are going to be, I mean, there are some companies that are really in an impressive position now. It doesn't mean they're going to win, but they're very well placed. Google is one of them. General Motors is another one, I would say. Ford is coming up fast, but it's got ground to make up. And it's working hard on that. Chrysler basically has been very focused on getting itself in financial good shape. So it has not really spent a lot of time on autonomous, but VW has. Daimler, the maker of Mercedes-Benz, has, and you know, never underestimate Toyota. Toyota is doing very good work, but very quiet work in this area. And then there are all kinds of companies in China we've never heard of, many people have never heard of, that are very interested in this technology and are working hard on it.
Speaking of Ford having to catch up, you just wrote an article for Worth Magazine where you talked about why Ford Motor Company and Jim Hackett bought the train depot.
Okay, so the train depot here in Detroit was really one of the great urban eyesores of all time. I mean, one of the real disgraces of the city. It embarrassed everybody. It didn't have windows for a while. The Maroons owned it. They weren't taking care of it properly. They got pushed a bit to put windows on it and cut the weeds and make it look a little better. But basically, it was a big disgrace. And Ford came along and bought it and is going to pour. Who knows how much they spent for it? I doubt they spent a lot of money for it, but they're going to spend a lot of money fixing it up for sure. And the idea is to make that into the center of their mobility campus here in Detroit. And so they are going to use this as a very powerful symbol to internally and externally that they are dedicated to this digital future and this autonomous future, this ride-hailing future that everybody believes is coming very fast. And it's going to be a way to attract the young talent that they need. They need to attract the kinds of engineers who are coming out of MIT and Michigan, Michigan State and Purdue and all these places, but then head straight to the West Coast to work for Google and for NVIDIA and do graduate work at Stanford. We need them to stay here in Detroit. And one of the things that's happened with the resurgence of Detroit is it's become a much cooler place for young people. And now with Ford's campus, they're hoping that they'll come and work for Ford or for some of the Ford partners that are going to be there. And I think it's the promise of the project is tremendous. Obviously, we're going to have to see how it turns out. Execution is everything. But it seems like it's a very powerful idea.
Daron, you've interviewed so many phenomenal people these last 35 years. If you could interview any one living person on Earth, who would it be?
Wow. That's a great question. I'd like to interview Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel. I've been an admirer of his. Everybody seems to despise the guy lately, but I'm a little bit of a counter thinker in that way. I admired him very much. I admired his late father, who was a an academic, a very serious academic, who was a specialist in the Spanish Inquisition. His brother, a lot of people don't know, was a war hero in Israel and was actually the only person that was killed in the raid on Entebbe in 1976 that was got a lot of attention the day of the of America's 200th birthday. They were able to free these hostages that were being held in Uganda, and Netanyahu's older brother Yoni, who my wife knew slightly, was killed in that raid. So I'd love to meet and talk to Benjamin Netanyahu.
What's the biggest thing your radio show has taught you, Daron Levine, these past 3 years?
I think it's about when you're writing for a newspaper, you're conducting an interview, you're getting a lot of information, and then you're taking that information and selectively choosing that from that information, facts, quotes, whatever came out of it, in order to meet a theme for your story. Some of it gets discarded, some of it gets saved for another time, some of it gets used at that time. So you're really thinking about that interview that way. When you do a radio interview, you're really conducting a conversation. You're talking to somebody and you're interested in what they have to ask you, and then you're not asking the questions. I'm not asking you, Jack, the questions, but we're really having a conversation. You're kind of interrogating me in a nice way, you know, like as if we were sitting over a meal or having a drink at a bar or something like that. I try to create, if I can, conversations with people that other people would like to overhear.
And you do a great job of that. As our time winds down, what advice would you give to our young listeners?
Well, I would say, for instance, for people who, young people who are interested in journalism, don't despair about what's happening out there. You hear a lot about fake news. Back in my day, we called it disinformation. There's a lot of this that's being used for political purposes from all sides. People need good information. They need people who know how to think. They need people who know how to express themselves and to build bridges. You know, life is always about people, and it's about communication and about communicating in a respectful way, in an intelligent way, and in a way that somebody can take some value away from that conversation. So don't ever despair. Don't feel that journalism is over, or writing is over, or newspapers are over, or communicating is over. It's not over. It's always here, as long as there are people here.
And I would add one thing. If a young man wanted to say, how do I become a classy man, just study up on Daron Levine and do what he lives.
You're very kind, Jackie. And as your dad always used to say, stay humble. That's a good piece of advice. Always stay humble.
Thank you. Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spahn.
Believe in yourself.